Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The president tweets, News Corp hacks, nail polish is back. I think that's 140 characters. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by MassMutual, offering LifeBridge to help lower-income families protect their children's education at massmutual.com/lifebridge.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. This one is the 6th of July.
I am going to make history here as the first president to live tweet.
Tempting as it is to just close up shop and go home after hearing that from the leader of the free world, there is actually a story or two to be told about the president's Twitter town hall today. One is political, that the White House is clearly going to use social media in the 2012 campaign to look 2008, look positively retro. Another angle is what the presidential seal of approval means for Twitter's corporate fortunes. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Twitter is always good for a headline, whether it's Charlie Sheen tweeting about his tiger blood or Anthony Weiner sending photos to the ladies. But President Obama's town hall shows Twitter's more substantive side.
We've passed the adolescent stage here.
Josh Burnoff is an analyst with Forrester Research. He says Twitter wants to be taken seriously.
I think you'll see Twitter concentrate on becoming a communications channel of record here. So the presence of Barack Obama on there is pretty important.
That's because Twitter is looking to go public, which means it has to convince investors it provides a crucial service to its customers. Sam Ford is director of digital strategies for Peppercom. He says a lot of social media companies have to prove they're not just a flash in the pan.
Some wonder whether they're substantial or they have staying power, even though most of them have a user base that any other company would kill for.
Twitter has more than 200 million users. Not that it's figured out how to make money off of them. Jeff Jarvis is the author of What Would Google Do?
Twitter is an amazing beast. It really is a new way to find out what's happening all around the world, but it still doesn't have a business model.
Jarvis says events like the Twitter town hall could help attract new advertisers. Twitter's on track to make about $150 million in ad revenue this year, which is still a far cry from what Twitter reportedly says it's worth, $7 billion. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Rupert Murdoch had a very bad day in the markets today. Shares of his major investment, that would of course be his own company, News Corp, tumbled as a long-running scandal involving one of his British newspapers broke out into the open. The Sunday tabloid News of the World has been accused of snooping into the lives of ordinary and very vulnerable people. In a statement today, Murdoch called the paper's actions deplorable and unacceptable. Sadly for him, Murdoch's corporate partners are reacting that way too. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The list of alleged victims grows longer by the day, and the alleged intrusiveness grows ever more repellent. 6 years ago, Graham Fulks learned that his young son David had died in a terrorist bombing on the London Tube. Now Graham has been told that in the days and weeks after the blast, the News of the World may have hacked into his phone looking for juicy quotes.
The real emotional turmoil and state that we were in, and that somebody was listening to that. It's a violation, isn't it?
This and many other revelations triggered an emergency debate in Parliament this afternoon. Prime Minister David Cameron said if the allegations are true, they constitute a gross invasion of privacy.
We're talking about murder victims, potentially terrorist victims, having their phones hacked into. It is absolutely disgusting.
And illegal. The News of the World editor at the time of the worst alleged excesses was Rebecca Brooks, now head of Murdoch's British subsidiary, News International. Company spokesman Simon Greenberg says Brooks has launched a full-scale internal inquiry.
She's now leading, effectively, the clean-up of the whole of the issue. She is the chief executive of this company, and she is leading and is determined to lead this company throughout this whole process.
Many public figures say Brooks should resign. The News of the World also felt the wrath of its advertisers. Half a dozen, including Ford, have withdrawn their business. Max Hastings is a former newspaper editor. He says the News of the World may have got into this mess, striving in a highly competitive market to maintain its role as News International's most lucrative title.
There is a good deal of evidence that the News of the World has gone to fantastic and indeed appalling lengths to get the kind of stories that produce these extraordinary revenues for NI.
News International's revenue from the News of the World is now likely to decline. It's not yet clear how much damage this rapidly unfolding scandal will do to the Murdoch brand in Britain. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back here in the States, the Environmental Protection Agency is in something of a rulemaking mood. Over the next couple of months, the EPA is expected to hold forth on everything from carbon dioxide to car exhausts. And coming up tomorrow, new rules to cut the smog and soot from power plants. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Here's my best impression of politicians talking about environmental rules. They're job killers, are not, are too, are not. You get the point. But these environmental regulations are political because they're about more than green trees and clean air. They're about money. On the cost side, the EPA estimates energy companies will need to pay about $3 billion to comply with the new smog rule. Some plants will probably close down. And for you and me?
All of these regulations would likely result in an increase in the cost of power.
Mitten Chalabi is an analyst at the economic consulting firm The Brattle Group. The EPA estimates the price of electricity could inch up around 2%. But there are economic benefits to clean air. According to the EPA, the new rule could save between $120 and $290 billion.
Maybe if we were in a different political mindset, we wouldn't call it the Environmental Protection Agency. Maybe we'd call it the Environmental Investment Agency.
Lisa Marganelli is with the nonpartisan New America Foundation. She says a lot of the benefit comes in the form of better public health. Less asthma, fewer sick days, fewer early deaths.
Putting those scrubbers on the tip of the smokestack sounds kind of abstract, but the quality of life issues are actually really real.
The White House Office of Management and Budget recently released a report estimating the economic costs and benefits of EPA rules. It found the long-term benefits dwarf the initial price tag. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, low volume, low volatility. Did we mention it's July? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Winter sports fans among us can go right ahead and book tickets now for Pyeongchang, South Korea. After falling just short in two previous tries, today that city landed the 2018 Winter Olympics. So it's time to start building those luge runs and hockey arenas. And don't forget the athletes' village that has to be bigger and better than the one before. Sure, it's a lot of money to go to and a lot of trouble as well, but it's a small price to pay for... Wait, for what exactly? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Horwich.
It's hard to imagine the other finalists in the room, France and Germany, freaking out quite like the South Koreans when their name got called.
If it's just about economics, there's really no justification for the giddiness.
Sports economist Rob Boddy at Lake Forest College says, party now, Pyeongchang, because the hangover is a doozy.
There's a spike in economic activity, of course, while the events are actually held. But after the games, and even a month before, we've noted some dead time.
Every Olympic bid comes with rosy research showing a boom in investment, tourists, jobs, and a bunch of creative uses for that new curling rink. University of Chicago economist Alan Sanderson says, toss it all out.
So the old line is, you know, never ask a barber if you need a haircut. I've often said if you take whatever number they give you and move the decimal point one to the left, it's probably much more accurate.
Next year's London Summer Games could run five times over budget, And timing is everything. The last Winter Olympics in Vancouver hit during the recession. Tough time to convert the Olympic Village into condos. But of course, Sanderson says, it's not just about economics.
There are always these sort of public relations aspects. You know, how much is this worth getting your city on the world stage?
You know, like Lillehammer or that other place in Italy or wherever that was. Still, maybe it's all worth it for those 2 weeks in the sun. Unless, of course, that sun melts all your snow like it did in Vancouver. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
If you believe the adage about real estate, that bit about the three most important things being location, location, and location, then one would think there are a few places worse to own a home than the Gaza Strip. Israel's got a naval blockade going. There's the not incidental risk of rocket fire and bombings. The political situation is fluid at best, and yet home prices in the Gaza Strip are up sharply. Reese Ehrlich reports now from Gaza City.
On a wide street packed with expensive homes and condos, real estate broker Essam Mortaja walks with confidence.
This is the best place in the world. Real estate markets collapsed everywhere else, but here it just goes up.
Mortaja is so bullish, he's about to put his own house on the market. The three-bedroom, two-bath house will go for $900,000. What makes it worth that kind of money?
You have a great view of the Mediterranean. The whole world wants to own property here. It's clean and safe. It's the best neighborhood in Gaza.
1.6 million Gazans are packed into 140 square miles of land, one of the highest population densities in the world. So, like Manhattan and San Francisco, limited space plus high demand equals high prices. But only a small number of business people and professionals returning from lucrative jobs abroad can afford it. A forklift lowers a pallet of concrete blocks at a construction site as Suhail Halima looks on. The wealthy businessman just paid $1 million for this lot in downtown Gaza City. Halima estimates real estate prices have gone up 20% since last year.
The U.S. dollar and Jordanian dinar have lost value. Gold is at an all-time high, so land is a good investment.
Israeli authorities have periodically bombed and sent tanks into Gaza. They say it's a necessary response to Palestinian attacks on Israel. Halima says even the threat of future military action hasn't cooled the real estate market.
The Israeli army destroyed one of my warehouses worth $1.6 million. We rebuilt the warehouse, but the land kept its value.
While land is a preferred investment for the rich, it remains unaffordable to the vast majority of Gazans, whose median income is $800 per year. In addition, a lot of housing stock was destroyed or damaged during the three-week war with Israel that ended in January 2009. Ziad al-Zaza, a former deputy prime minister, says the Hamas government has tried to provide help.
The government distributed $69 million to help those whose farms or houses were destroyed in the war. The government has recently sold land at subsidized prices to the poor. The recipients then spend their own money to construct apartments.
But so far, these government efforts are limited, and home ownership is just a dream for most Palestinians. Back on the ritzy side of Gaza City, real estate broker Mortaja hopes to find more customers for pricey homes. He set up a website in an effort to lure investment from Palestinians living in the U.S.
Come and invest. You'll make more money here. Now you can invest in real estate and see a profit in just a couple of weeks.
Mortaja is bullish, but with political instability still a threat here, no one can really say how long real estate prices will keep going up. In Gaza City, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
Reese's story was funded by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on crisis reporting. Coming up
this season, the popular colors are bright blue and neon orange.
Whatever happened to like pinks and reds?
pinks and reds are very passe, Kai. I mean, where have you been?
Yeah, I don't know. More than I ever thought I'd learn about the business of nail polish. But first, let's do the numbers. It was a winning but relatively quiet day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials climbed 56 points, about 0.5%, finished at 12,626. The NASDAQ up 8 points, better than 0.25%, closed at 2834. The S&P 500 notched up a single point, 0.1%, 1339 at the bell. Transportation stocks chugged ahead, and that could be cause for optimism down the track. Union Pacific shares finished higher by 0.8%. Stock in United Parcel gained almost 1%. FedEx shares delivered a gain of 1.3%. Also, stock in trucking giant Conway accelerated more than 5.5% today. It was less than a month ago that President Obama announced the release of 30 million barrels of oil from the nation's strategic reserve, aimed, one thought, at lowering prices during the busy summer travel season. Resulting price drop, though, didn't last long. The cost of U.S. crude settled today at $96 a barrel, about a half a buck higher than it was just before the news broke on June the 22nd. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Barron's Magazine, providing market ideas and insights to help readers manage their investments and protect their financial well-being. Online at Barron's.com. By Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Are air-conditioned malls pulling in summer shoppers? Chain stores report sales figures for June. The House Budget Committee discusses budgeting for America's national security. And President Obama is scheduled to continue conversations on the deficit at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Best estimates are that there are about 120,000 illegal immigrants living in Alabama right now. Most of them went for jobs in construction and agriculture. But come September, it's going to be a crime to rent them a place to live or to give them a ride someplace, let alone hire them. A lot of people are unhappy about the state's tough new immigration law, including the groups that are supposed to enforce it. Gigi Duban reports now from Birmingham.
It's a hot summer afternoon, and the Mimosa Trailer Park is awfully quiet. This is part of Deputy Randy Nash's beat. He's with the Sheriff's Department in Jefferson County, the state's most populous.
This is Mimosa Trailer Park right here. This is 99.9% Hispanic right here.
And then a Mexican woman flags him down.
Hey, sweetie. Hola, hola. ¿Cómo está?
Now, before we get into why she flags him down, know that under the new law, Nash would have to ask this woman to prove she's here legally. And if she couldn't, he would have to haul her off to jail. But even when the law takes effect in September, Nash might not bother to ask about legal status.
I don't have time for none of it because it can get overwhelming. We already stretched very thin.
Alabama Republican Senator Scott Beeson sponsored the new immigration law, said to be the nation's toughest to date. Beeson declined to be interviewed on tape, but told me the law is no different than any other passed by the state. And he said the police don't have the choice of not enforcing it.
I would disagree with Senator Beeson on that, and maybe he needs to come down here and see what we really do.
That's Chief Deputy Randy Christian, spokesman for the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office.
Really, the way it reads is unprecedented in what we've done in the past, and yeah, I think it gives us the authority to just hold a person without bond in our jail just because we suspect that they may be here illegally.
Christian says the county jail is overcrowded as it is.
We got a jail that is built for 900 people that averages 1,200 a day now. And I don't know where Senator Basin thinks we're going to put them and clothe them and feed them.
Jefferson County has been teetering on the brink of bankruptcy for the past 3 years. The sheriff's department recently slashed manpower by 20%. The deputies remaining stopped working car accidents. State troopers do that now. So Christian and police in other cities see this law as an unfunded mandate.
Our focus is going to be on violent crime. And, you know, this right now is not on the forefront for us, and it's not our priority right now.
Okay, let me see if I can understand. Someone broke into the house.
Back at Mimosa Trailer Park, Deputy Nash's priority is investigating why the Mexican woman flagged him down. She tells him she witnessed a break-in next door, and she's scared. Nash promises to return and check up on her.
Thank you so much.
All right, sweet. You be good, okay?
And in all likelihood, come September, he won't be asking for proof of citizenship. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday, so yeah, letters.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our commentary yesterday about the Tour de France, that one way to eliminate cheating in that race might be to make performance-enhancing drugs legal, did not go over well at all with Aladia. John Saylor from Clemson, South Carolina, says we missed the point entirely.
If you use a chemical to improve performance, this isn't inherently wrong. Only in the sense that it's not inherently wrong to get four strikes at bat. What's wrong is to get four strikes at bat when the rules permit only three.
Stefan Bashinsky from Thorndale, Pennsylvania, offers his own modest proposal. Non-cheaters race with non-cheaters.
Such as a drug-free Tour de France and a steroids-only Tour de France, for example. Athletes that want to stay clean should be allowed to stay clean and have competition available to them.
The collapsing case against former IMF chief Dominic Strauss-Kahn made its way to our live broadcast from Aspen, Colorado last Friday, and our weekly wrap with Heidi Moore, our New York bureau chief, and Christia Friedland from Reuters. It was suggested at one point in that discussion that perhaps we were too quick to assume Mr. Strauss-Kahn's guilt after the sexual assault charges were filed. Several of you, yeah, many of you wrote to object, including Madeline Lockwood from Astoria, Oregon.
Sadly, we have a long history in this country of not believing rape victims and defending their attackers. It is disturbing to me that these educated women would be so quick to assume that this woman is lying, and that Mr. Strauss-Kahn, who has a history of misbehavior, is guiltless.
In her defense, I am obliged to say that Heidi assumed no such thing on the broadcast that day. Finally, a thought about the Consumer Price Index, one of the ways economists measure inflation. One source in our story last week said some consumers switch their buying habits when stuff gets expensive, and that they may be just as happy with something else. David O'Neill of Shoreview, Minnesota said, yeah, no.
If he truly believes that, he should be willing to trade cars with me. He can be just as happy with my old beater as I'm sure I will be with whatever fancy new car he can afford.
We want to hear from you no matter what you drive. Send us your letters at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Also on our website this week, by the way, a special online preview of our China series that starts Monday. We spent the first 2 weeks of June over there reporting, following up on our broadcast from 5 years ago. Our web element launches today. It's on our homepage, marketplace.org. Shorts and sandals, women in sundresses. Yes, it's summertime, and after a couple of years of recession-induced belt tightening, women are starting to put a little color back on themselves. We turn to Kate Betts from time to time when we want to know what to wear, or in this case, what to put on our nails. Hey, Kate, how are you?
I'm good, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. I'm getting by. But here's the thing. As happens most times that we talk, I am out of my depth because this whole nail polish thing, it's got me a little confused because I thought lipstick was the luxury that sort of accessorized everything.
Well, no, not anymore. Apparently, nail polish has completely triumphed over lipstick. This is a way that people can do something different and kind of fun in a basically inexpensive way. One of the reasons that nail polish has taken off is the color. And there are all sorts of colors out there. This season, the popular colors are bright blue and neon orange.
Wow. Whatever happened to, like, pinks and reds?
Pinks and reds are very passe, Kai. I mean, where have you been?
You know, I was known in my youth to dabble in a little bit of nail polish. And you know, I've got a seven-year-old who likes to have his nails painted every now and then. But the point being, I suppose, is it a moneymaker? I mean, you know, what does a bundle of nail polish sell for? A couple of bucks probably, right?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, Essie is a company that was recently sold to L'Oreal for a lot of money, and they sell their nail polish bottles for $7.
Ooh.
But Chanel, for example, which is a prestige brand, sells for a little bit more, more along the lines of $25
a
bottle.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. And by the way, the business has been growing very rapidly. I mean, I think in 2009, it was up 11% in this country, $462 million business.
You mentioned Chanel and you mentioned SC. I mean, is this a big brand thing, or are there boutique markets? I mean, how does it break down?
Well, there are a lot of boutique brands. There's obviously a lot of mass market brands like Revlon, things that you can buy in a pharmacy, mm-hmm. or a Duane Reade. But then there are smaller brands like OPI, based out of Los Angeles. Then there are the more boutique ones like Deborah Lipman, who's a celebrity manicurist. Oh. There's even a nail polish company called Uslu, which is a Swedish airline company that makes nail polish. And all of their colors are named after airport abbreviations, like those three-letter abbreviations.
We are so totally doing a marketplace nail polish thing. We're going to come out with a whole line.
Let me know if you need any naming help. That's the big thing with nail polish.
Kate Betts, her book is called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Kate, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day on the web at manta.com. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, motorists in the Motor City aren't going to be too happy about this, but parking officials in Detroit are going to start cracking down. As of tomorrow, they're going to be writing tickets until 10 p.m. weeknights. Right now, they clock out at 6. Local businessmen are not amused at all, including John Castiglione. He's the chef at Rub Barbecue and Pub right in downtown.
Anywhere in the downtown district during the weekdays, we have a hard time drawing crowds, especially for restaurants and bars and clubs. And when people do have to come down here and also worry about parking and paying for parking, it's just one more reason why not to come downtown.
A cash-strapped city's got to do what a cash-strapped city's got to do, I suppose. All right, that's it from us. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow advanced 56 points. That's almost 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 8 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 edged up a single point, 0.1%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, you ever smoke pot? You ever illegally download music?
The mere fact that you guys have answered yes to one of those questions could mean that if you were to apply for a security clearance, you may have an issue.
Oh, man. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.